I'm really struggling with this morning. Spot the tech guy. So this question of digital asset management, you know, as we talked about last week, it's an exploding world. People got lots and lots of stuff to manage. You guys obviously specialize in images. Robert, you've got a whole website and a whole methodology around this. So you're going to talk to us about that this morning and some of the software?
I'm going to name a few products. There are a lot of products, like there are a lot of apps out there.
Right. One of the questions we got towards the end of the show last week, and I might take it head on if that's all right. Hang on, where is it? What program would your photographers recommend to be able to search for a photo? Entering data about that photo so you can search for the photo later. What are the advantages and disadvantages of Mac versus PC, Picasa, Lightroom, blah, 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 blah. So I think that kind of goes to the core of everything, doesn't it?
Pretty much, yes. Yeah. People, there is no one program that will do everything for everyone, just like the iPhone doesn't suit absolutely everyone or an Android phone.
I just don't understand that.
But photographers in particular, or creatives in general, want just a panacea that's going to fix every problem that they've got. And because they drive the market, that's pretty much where it follows. Right. I will mention a few programs, and it depends upon how deep you want to get into it, from a very large company to just an individual.
Well, my primary focus with this show is business owners. Mm-hmm. So let's take the case of somebody who isn't a professional photography studio, mm-hmm. but they amass a lot of images in the course of their work. Maybe they have imagery for their online store, they've got cataloging info, events, all those sorts of things. You know, I'm sure there are people around who have this problem who aren't photographers.
And not all creatives. So that can be graphic designers, it could be website designers, it could be anyone that's got multimedia content, I suppose.
Yes. Yeah.
The program, if you want just one program, it's currently called Phase One Media Pro. I believe we mentioned that last week. If you go to Phase One, PHASE One, or one word, which is, sorry, I should spell it, O-N-E,
number one?
Not number one, but yeah. I'm sure they probably have a redirect if their marketing team's onto it. Or just Google Phase One.
Right.
So it's not F, it's PH at the beginning. This is a program they've purchased, acquired from Microsoft a few years ago, who Microsoft purchased off a small English company.
Yes.
And it is a true multimedia, so it can catalogue images, raw images, JPEG images, movies, anything your iPhone or Android phone puts out,
right.
as well as the stuff. In fact, it can catalog any program. So it can catalog websites, it can catalog animated GIFs,
so
PNGs.
So by catalog them, what does that so mean when, for an amateur like me? Does that mean it goes and reads the website and works out what the images are, names them, gets any...
When you look at the thumbnail, it shows you a thumbnail of the website. Now, whether that's been kept up to date, because the web moves very quickly with what is standard, so it's typically a HTML file. But if you've got a website you like the style of, and maybe you've got to show that to a client, you just want to make a note of it,
mm-hmm.
That's probably not its primary function as a cataloging program. A number of clients of mine are just a mess, as I'm sure you've seen. Clients have got content everywhere. So I say, look, what we'll do is we'll just lift the hard drive and drop it onto the icon, and we'll come back in a few hours, and it catalogues everything in your computer.
I went into a client site this week, and it's a brand new client. I met them for the first time. They took me into their computer room. Without a word of exaggeration, there must have been 200 hard drives in there.
Oh my God.
And I said, what's on that? And he said, content. And I said, do you know how to find any of this stuff?
Drive 182 in the corner.
He didn't even have that.
God.
He had a spreadsheet, and on it was the very, you know, manually kept up to date list of what he thought was on that drive, not down to the image level. Just, you know, I did this shoot on that day. You know, as a video photographer, and holy cow, what a nightmare!
Did you take a selfie of your expression then?
Robert, have you compared the Phase One software to Lightroom at all?
Lightroom is great, but it doesn't catalog every multimedia format, so it won't catalog PNG files or Flash files or anything like that, even though, ironically, Adobe owned Flash now. This other program is a multimedia cataloging program. It was created by an employee at BBC to make those old-fashioned things called interactive CDs.
Yes.
So he had to catalogue everything. He was the guy that started programming for it. This became more successful, so he quit his day job, the good old tech story.
Yes.
Yeah. This is in the 80s. But what it will do, once you've thrown your hard drive or 200 hard drives on top of the icon, it will then make it much easier because you'll have it down a panel, you'll see all the different file types. You'll see the dates they were created. Right. You'll see which hard drive that is on. And it's a visual database. That's a good thing. I've seen similar circumstances that you just described, David. Mm. And it's on disk 001 or my disk. Because yes. they've just taken the default burn.
Yeah.
This will at least point them to something like the serial number or the unique ID number. But being a visual, all you've got to think of, and this is how I describe searching for anything in any database, you don't have to know the keyword because you might not have keyworded it.
Almost certainly haven't keyworded
it. Most don't. So you just have to think, what am I looking for? Is it an image or a movie? And that will then filter it down. Do I remember roughly what year? Great. Or what month? Great. That will keep narrowing it down. And when you've narrowed it down to even just a few hundred images, then you just scroll through the thumbnails and you can find it quickly. But it might be some other thing that tweaks. It might be the camera you use to record it. And again, you can just filter it down by that. But until then, you're just looking at a room with 200 hard drives.
That would be a photographer's view of the world. What camera did I use? My camera?
but not only that, the lenses you used as well to shoot it, you can search by that with some software.
So that stuff gets recorded in the metadata on the image anyway, doesn't it?
Mm.
I think most people kind of know that, I think, because if you're using iPhone or something on your Mac, at least it does pop up with that information if you look behind the image. But you've got to know to go and look for it.
Yes, yeah. And it is recorded. So metadata, there are two types of metadata that are important to photographers. There are some standards for that. There's the EXIF data. Don't ask me what that EXIF stands for. But all camera manufacturers, including Apple and everyone else, agreed that this is where you store the fields, such as camera, shutter speed. And it's not a silly thing to catalogue, because if I know that I shot that on my iPhone, I'm not going to go and look through all the various cameras I've owned during my life. I can remember this was roughly that date, so... As Eden said, you can actually look for the lens or any way that helps you find your image.
Yeah, I guess we should also explain what metadata is. Yeah, metadata is data about the image. It's not the image itself, but it describes the image. Yeah?
Incredibly geeky. So it's data about data.
Yes. It doesn't get much geekier than that, does it?
But the advantage of... So there's EXIF data, and other data that we catalogue is IPTC, which I do know stands for International Press Trade Council. And you... Hold up your hand if I'm getting too geeky here,
no,
David.
No.
So EXIF is automatic.
Geek out.
Geek out, yeah.
If you've got your iPhone or a compact camera or very few DSLRs, well, in fact, no DSLRs really do it, but some can connect a GPS device and it will record where it's taken. So again, you might not, it's just a way of filtering it down. I remember I was in Perth when I took that photo, so you can filter it.
Certainly iPhones do that because you can geolocate your images in iPhoto. Or is it iPhoto? Yeah.
Yep, in iPhoto. And Lightroom, that Eden mentioned, can do it. And this program, Phase 1 Media Pro, you can actually go back afterwards and geocode and push that data back in.
Right. But
that's EXIF data. So it's automatic stuff that your camera records about when and where you took it.
Yeah.
The IPTC data is an agreed set of fields created by the newspapers in the 70s, which is appropriate for the music today.
Yeah.
Because back in the old days, they'd process their film in the hotel room back in Iraq, version 1, and then they'd have to scan it on a really bad scanner and send it over an old-fashioned telephone line to get to the newspapers around the world. So they had to have a field that went into that.
Incredibly analog.
Oh, absolutely. But this would be going around the world. Now, who took the photo? What was it of? So they agreed, the newspapers agreed on standards. And we still use those standards today.
They'd also probably want to do that to be able to protect their copyright in the image as well.
That's right. So typically, who took the photo, the credit was very important.
Yeah.
But we've used those fields now. So we can put our contact information in there, the keywords, which is very important with laws changing around the world, and I'll try not to get my photographer's hat on too much. But people, very soon, potentially in Australia, anyone can take your photos and use them professionally. So it could be the next advertisement, I won't name brands, for X brand soft drink, and they can use your photo if they don't know that you took it, David, without paying you.
Really?
Naturally, photographers are fighting. That's happened in London, so the UK's the latest ones. It's called Orphan Works.
Wow.
Which means that if people do a fair and reasonable search for your image and can't find you, which means they might have just looked on Google, I don't know who took this photo. Yeah, I'm allowed to use it.
What qualifies as fair and reasonable in that?
It's very grey area. Yeah. So
even with families and children and things like that?
Anything. But, of course, then they get silly because there's things with model releases. Whereas if you start using this stuff, which I've been advocating, this has been coming down the pipeline for over 10 years. This is before the Australian government now. It could happen. So protect your images as professionally or amateur. If you put that metadata in there, when it comes up, they'll be able to find you. And these are not hidden fields. Just looking at file info in app. Oh.
So is that something you would set by default in your camera?
Or when I download, and you can do it in Lightroom or Phase 1 Media Pro or Picasa.
Stuff, and it just appends to each image as an import?
That's right.
Does that you do, Eden, as well?
Yeah, I do. So my metadata basically says my name, my website, so anyone can contact me. It's easy.
And can anybody clear that data out of the image? Afterwards?
Yes, which is illegal. It's against the DCMA, the Digital Copyright Millennium Act. The problem is proving that they did it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it is illegal. But on the same foot, it's illegal to use an image at today unless you can contact the owner. If this Orphan Works comes through, then that changes. The idea behind it is that there are a whole lot of images out there we can't use because we don't know who owns it. So this, the idea behind it is the notion's nice, but the practicalities of it's not.
So if I go to Google Images and I stumble across one of your images there, how do I reasonably check that it's you? I mean, is it simple as right-click on it and get info or something like that?
Google is actually pretty good. Picasa, you've mentioned, that's pretty good too. It honours it. Websites, social media is very popular. I don't have to mention that. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, they all strip the metadata when you upload your images.
And that's only recently with Facebook as well, which is a shame.
They strip it. They actively strip it.
Take it out. So there are lobbies of various organisations to stop that. Right. But, I mean, there are other issues too. You upload it to Instagram, you give them unlimited usage anyway. And if there is someone in it that doesn't want to be photographed or have their work used commercially, when you've signed up to Instagram, you've accepted that you'll take responsibility.
Right. So if you put an image up and it's got a face in the background that you haven't sort of pixelated out, somebody sees themselves turn up on Instagram, you, as the photographer, have that issue, not Instagram. Even though they strip out the metadata.
Well, it turns up on Instagram promoting or on Facebook as an advertisement.
Commercial.
You're in trouble. And that happened. A practical case of that Vodafone, the local Vodafone, not the German one, did an advertisement where they went to Flickr and just pulled off a whole lot of images and put them on bus shelters around Australia. And the person in the photo from Singapore didn't like the fact that she was being used to advertise Vodafone. So sued Vodafone.
Wow.
Because she didn't give permission.
So does this fall under copyright or asset management?
Well, digital asset management protects your moral and copyright. So it is very important. As you said, when I don't do this, I don't sit through and do all my photos. It automatically imports, adds all my copyright information.
Yeah.
And then whenever I make a duplicate or a version of it, it puts that into the new version.
Gets carried across, yeah.
And so it's out there. I think it's important for anyone, professional or otherwise, any business. That's your intellectual property. So if you said you were putting out your software, you know that you've got intellectual property. You'd put the usage rights with the...
Okay. So for a photographer who is professionally producing this stuff, it makes total sense. For, you know, maybe an amateur photographer or somebody maybe who aspires to a professional career, but they don't yet have the revenue base to go and buy these more expensive programs. Is there does iPhoto do that? Does it allow you to, append that sort of information to it as you bring it in? I mean, I use iPhoto just an example. I'm sure Windows Picture Manager or something like that.
They all allow you and they all read that metadata.
Right. But does it allow you to set a copyright notice in there as well?
For a cross-platform solution, look at Picasa.
Yes. Yeah, Picasa's just... They've lifted their image allowance to a terabyte per user or something?
I think that was Flickr.
Flickr, yes. Mm. Yeah, it was Flickr. You're right, sorry.
I'm a huge advocate of Lightroom. I'd recommend if you're an amateur photographer and you're getting into it more and more, jump into Lightroom and it's
very Lightroom easy. Come with the Creative Suite as part of it? Or is it a separate product again?
It's a separate product.
Right.
I'll have to put my disclaimer. I'm an Adobe Creative Professional, which means I don't get paid for it, but I'm acknowledged by Adobe, so that they help me if I put on workshops. So that they've now got Creative Cloud, which I'm sure you've spoken about.
So we just put a client on it last week, actually, and she's just thrilled to bits. $50 a week, and she's got everything. $50 a month, right? Yeah.
If you're on the old system of licensing, where you get the box or download the software, then Lightroom's not included. But on Creative Cloud, it's all you can eat for $30 or $50. So it includes so Lightroom
is included.
Yes. All their software titles, it's great. I use the cloud, love it.
So you've gone to Creative Cloud as well?
Yeah, I love it. It's great.
Oh, okay, maybe that's another topic we could talk about one day, because more and more of these platforms are moving to software as a utility, and you just rent what you need. So.
Mm.
We're talking digital asset management with my two photographers, Eden Connell and Robert Edward. Is it Edward or Edwards?
Edwards.
I'll get that right, sorry. And you have a website at damsimple.com and photographer.com.au, is that right? Hang on, it'd be good if I turn your mics on, yeah. Really struggling with the mics this morning. There we go.
Yeah, photographer.com.au is the best place to go, and there's a blog as well as a link
that
for workshops.
That is an awesome URL. I don't know how you got that, but
I want to hear the story. How did you get it?
Do you want the truth or the... No. the good story is it was just dumb luck in that when URLs became available, I had to go on the internet, and I was sick of having the ISP's name and advertising that in every email. I thought, I'll just register. How do people find me in the yellow pages? They look up photographer. So I'll look, yes, this is available. This is quite a long time ago, of course.
Wow, that really had to be just dumb luck. Yeah.
But before that, you weren't allowed, you probably remember, David, you weren't allowed to register real names or occupations.
Yeah.
And so I actually registered and still have photographer.net.au. And then they decided to release it. I think it was I can't remember.
I can.
Then the one in Australia, they said, yes, we'll do a, bring a lot of money, we'll release all the names. So they put them up for auction, and I had to auction... I had to bid for photographer.com.au, and it kept going up and up and up. So I paid a reasonable amount of money, and that's to protect my name, as photographer.net.au.
That's extraordinary. I mean, I won't ask the amount of money, but it's not often that you hear people actually have to go into bidding wars to get a domain.
Mm.
And these days, I mean, one of the first things when people are naming their business is they check all the namespaces, you know, make sure it's available as a handle on Twitter and Facebook and, you know, all these other places where they might want to be known, as well as their URL for it.
I had to change my business name to get the URL as well, so it's the same sort of thing. But I wasn't quick enough on Facebook, I can't remember. Yeah, if you're starting a business, the business name's probably decided by the social handles as much.
Yeah, my word. And Eden, yours is a good one. Zoom in with Eden. I bet you weren't getting too much competition.
No, I didn't get any competition, but it's just for my business. It was just it was for a blog that I had overseas, and that's where it all came from. It's great. Yeah.
So did you name the business as a result of the blog? Like you had the URL first, and then the business just grew out of that, right?
And then it was simple. It was just called Zoom In With Eden, my business. You know?
Right.
So yeah. So it was. Now, just
and you recently ran an online voting competition for the tagline.
Oh god, I had some funny taglines.
What did you get?
I the final one, I can't
I know one of them was expose yourself with Eden or something.
Oh,
like that.
we had some shocking ones come through. I had a good friend that had a joke, and he sent through about 20 taglines. I'm not going to reveal them all because your listeners will turn off the radio, but the final one was Zoom In With Eden Photography, We Focus On You. So I'm
nice.
happy with that. So we've got a new site, and that's been live this week. So
you've got a new website too?
It's live. It's out there.
How's it look?
Yeah, fantastic. Happy? Yeah, I'm happy. Extremely happy. So
getting good feedback for it?
Very good feedback. So it's we had to get it live. It's just when you're doing websites, they take so long to do, and getting all the... It's very hard to go through your images and pick all the right and the best ones. So
is it hard as a photographer to differentiate yourself online?
Very much
so. Without giving away all your intellectual property, but, you know, putting your images out there. You've got to put some stuff in that makes people want to click through and find out more, but you don't want to give away your best stuff, do you?
If it's online, then people can steal it, like anything that's on the internet.
Right.
But you've still got to put your best stuff out there. Yes.
I think you've just got to show it.
Yeah.
And get it out there. So my best stuff's on my website.
Yeah.
But to pick all those images, I've actually recently gone through 6 years of images, and to pick the best of the best is an extremely hard job. So I've had
Do you get very critical of your own work?
You do, and you hold on to images as well. You have, like, I'm attached to so many of my different images, and sometimes you've got to go, nut that one's out. You know?
Attached to them emotionally because what they meant at the time?
Yeah.
Because what they mean to you may not necessarily transfer to, you know, somebody looking at your website looking for a wedding photographer or something like that. You know?
Totally.
Do you do wedding stuff?
Loads of weddings, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, my clients, when they look at the images, say you go on my website today and have a look, you probably won't have the feeling that I had at a wedding where the grandfather cried or the grandmother cried and I took that photo, and that means so much to me. So, yeah.
Yeah, but I think putting a grandfather crying, you know, at a wedding would be a very touching photograph, would make me want to click through and find out, well, who took that?
Yeah.
So, yeah, anyway. We digress. Let's get back to digital asset management. So we talked about Lightroom, and I think that's an Adobe product.
It is
an Apple product that came out around about the same time.
There are a few products out there that I'd say look at. So if you are a photographer, Lightroom is really the dominant player out there.
So the gold standard.
It is, and that's whether you're an amateur. I wouldn't say just a keen iPhoto photographer. You could certainly use it. For your smartphone photography, or an advanced professional. It is a great program, but it is definitely single user, so you can't share it amongst a work group. It catalogues raw files. The camera can, if your camera can produce raw files.
Sorry, hang on, just back up there a little bit. Lightroom is a single user product.
It is a single.
So you can't share the library on a network or something?
No.
And I wish you could. That's a downfall for me.
Wow.
With using the software.
I would have thought that was like, for a creative studio, like a base minimum requirement.
That's why I mentioned it is dominant for single users. I'm an alpha tester for Adobe. Alpha testers, just people Adobe go to but don't pay and say, what's the pain point?
Break it for me.
Basically, yes. Yeah. So, I mean, there's a great side story there. In one of their versions for Lightroom, they sent 20 photographers from around the world with the Adobe Lightroom team to Tasmania. I was fortunate enough to be invited on that. So we went down there, spent 2 weeks really pushing the product. Yeah. It was out for beta testing for the public, photographing amazing areas around Tasmania, processing the images.
There's
the engineers.
Guy who does the radio show in the US, Leo Laporte.
He was on it.
He
yes.
was on that trip.
Yeah,
well.
He was
so
with
I
us.
I remember listening to his podcast.
I was in the car time. While he was doing a podcast. I was in the front seat. He was in the back seat doing it. He had a lot of things to say about Australia. Beautiful stuff, but not too impressed by our technology, as in the telcos.
He's very, very vocal on that, on his show as well.
But
not
that
a
was
fan
great.
Of Telstra.
He's such a, I mean, he's a lovely bloke. He's such a funny bloke.
Is he?
Yes, absolutely. He's exactly how he appears on his show, is that's him.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a great single-user program, and there's no way at this stage that they'll, I mean, who knows what companies are doing, but there's no way to share it. Geeks out there have tried to come up with ways. There's another program I use that uploads your images to another website and you can download and look at it, so it looks like a virtual version of Lightroom, but it doesn't interact. So for a single user that's only photographing with photos and videos that DSLR cameras can record, it really is the benchmark. But if you're an...
And Eden, that's what you're using as well, right?
Love it.
Yeah. But as soon as if you then took on a bunch of employees who needed access to that, does that mean you then need to move up? We'll use another product name. And I stress, none of these people are advertisers or sponsors of the station, but it's hard in this program to have a technical discussion and not mention third-party products. That's just the nature of the beast.
And I felt that's what people want. They want you to name a few products and then they can see what's best for them.
So does that mean, like, does Phase 1 do
It's a bit kludgy. It can share it. In fact, Lightroom doesn't even let you put it on an external drive or a server, the catalogue. It has to reside on the internal hard drive of the computer. So they're forcing you to do that. There are ways of sharing it, and I'll keep you in tuned if anything turns up. Yeah. Phase 1, it locks the catalogue, so only one person can read-write, the rest can read it, and that's okay for a few users. But you can share it with clients, so you can actually email or Dropbox or whatever the catalogue, and they get like an Acrobat Reader version of it. It's a read-only, and they can give you feedback. Find the images they like, give feedback, and then they email a small file to you.
Do they still call it Acrobat Reader, or is it just Adobe Reader?
it's Acrobat,
And what about the Apple equivalent?
So Apple were first came
Anyone
off the
would
ring.
Think I was an Apple fan, wouldn't they?
Well, that's what I was going to say. If you're a one-eyed Apple diehard, there is Aperture, which became before Lightroom. They both have their costs and benefits. Lightroom is more future-proof. How it handles your images, it's non-destructive, as is Aperture, in that in the old days you open a JPEG in Photoshop or Microsoft anything. It would have to throw pixels away when you change it. This new cataloging program, only changes are made in the catalog.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a big difference. Aperture is the same. iPhoto is the same. The beauty of Aperture and iPhoto, which are Mac only, is they actually talk to each other. So if you're feeling in a really basic mode, or you want the family to share photos,
yeah,
or someone in your company who's not really advanced at imaging, they can use iPhoto, and then when you open that same catalog in Aperture, it'll see their corrections.
So you can park a catalog or a library file
on a
shared drive somewhere.
It's one catalog, and they can all play with it, but you don't want them to give access to all of the features in Aperture.
Right. So iPhoto is like Aperture Lite. Is that a good way to describe it?
Yeah. And Apple will probably be happy with that as well. You can also share it. Share it over the web. There's a third party open. I'll have to grab the name for you. Sorry, I haven't got it. I only just found out about it. There's a way of actually sharing it over the web as well. You can make changes and it'll appear across the other side. These are all just basically SQLite databases.
Yep. So, forgive my ignorance in this, because I'm not a user of Adobe products on a regular basis. Where does Bridge fit into all this? Because I always thought Bridge, and maybe Bridge is just an antique product. I don't know. Is that...
It's connected with Photoshop itself, but Lightroom's come out, so a lot of people are using Lightroom.
Right, so they've dropped Bridge and moved more.
Well, no, they've still got it. I'll let Robert jump in, because I'm sure he'd be a bit more technical in that aspect.
Bridge is definitely still there. If you download any of the Creative Suite, it's like an adjunct to it. It was invented with Photoshop, right, but it's an image browser, as opposed to a catalog. So with a cataloging program, like any of the ones we've mentioned, it will show you what's supposed to be there. If you disconnect the hard drive, it will still show you what's there.
So for our audience who perhaps don't know the difference then between an image browser and a catalog, can we put some simple language around that to differentiate the two?
Absolutely. So an image browser, which is like File Explorer or the Finder,
mm-hmm,
it shows you what's in that folder at the time. You point at it, it'll show you what's in there. Mm-hmm. If you delete the folder, anything in that folder, It's pretty straightforward. And that's what Bridge is. It's just, but it can read and display and play movies of any multimedia file type that Adobe support.
Right.
So it's a way of seeing your Illustrator files, your Acrobat files, your photos, your movies.
So if you had a project file there and you had some Illustrator images in there, some base photos that were bought in off the camera and finished, you know, multi-layered Photoshop files and things, it would be able to display all of those within Bridge.
That's right.
Without actually running the program.
That's right. So you can sort.
So you can see and move all the assets that belong to a project in one window.
Totally.
So Bridge is kind of, as the name suggests, bridging the gap between all those different.
That's
apps.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. That's, and I'm sure that's where they got the name from.
Right.
Okay. Whereas a cataloging program like Lightroom or Aperture or anything like that, it just catalogs what it sees at that time. The last time the catalog was told to go and look at that folder,
right,
it will catalog what's in there. Now, if you move,
because it's got a database behind it, it then becomes searchable.
Exactly, yes.
Right, okay. So there's a difference in simple terms.
Whereas if you delete out of the file using Bridge, but you didn't do that through Lightroom, Lightroom still thinks it should be there and it'll say, hold on, I don't know where this has gone. So the advantages of a catalogue...
Then you would have an orphaned database record in...
Like any database system that you use.
If you get rid of the thing that whatever the record points at, then the record comes along and says, hey, it's not there.
So that should have been our number two rule yesterday. If you start using a catalogue last week, if you start using a catalogue program, do all of your file management in that program. Start moving it, renaming it, or deleting it so that the catalogue knows where the asset's gone or changed.
And make sure that catalogue's backed up.
Yeah, well, we had that whole discussion last week. Yeah.
So, yeah, the couple of other programs I'll quickly mention. If you are on a larger work group, because there are bigger companies, Portfolio, it's a company called Extensis, which ironically was started by Adobe. They bought another company called Aldus. All the stuff they didn't think they wanted, they sold off. They made this other company and eventually sold it. Extensis Portfolio, it varies from a few hundred dollars from a single user up to tens of thousands of dollars if you want to have hundreds and hundreds of thousands, and it's scalable.
Right.
And that's the first program I used. You just buy the part that you want. It can run off a server, it can be a public-facing or not website. Right. It is expensive, as I've mentioned, tens of thousands of dollars if you want to, or if you're open source, you like to get your hands dirty, there's another one called Resource Space.
And you get a SourceForge or something like that and get that and do a build on it?
Go to resourcespace.com. You can download it. And the way those companies make money is if you do want support, You can pay them to do it.
Yeah, you pay for support.
But if you'd like getting your hands dirty, as I say, you can set it up, and it's a very robust multi-user work group solution.
Right. We're talking a lot about Lightroom and Aperture and things like that, but the cloud is something that is in general vernacular these days. Everyone's looking for a cloud solution to everything. Is there a cloud answer for asset management, image and or digital asset management?
Your audience might chime in if they know of one, but at this stage in Australia, no, and it's often due to the file sizes that we're dealing with and the speed or the network speed we can get.
Right.
So that is a problem. We spoke about that last week as well.
Good old NBN.
Eventually, yes. but certainly for small assets, there are sort of hodgepodge solutions out there, and there's no definite one I can point people to.
Right, okay. So it would be wrong for somebody to think of Picasa or Flickr or any of those as an asset management service or anything like that. They're really just a photo sharing site, aren't they?
It's a way to share files. And we spoke, again, when we talked about Dropbox, it's not really a storage or a backup solution. It's a way of delivering or sharing data.
Is somebody's phone ringing?
might be Kevin's.
Not to worry. I could hear a phone ringing there.
It's that familiar vibration. But there are solutions coming, I think.
I get nervous when the phone doesn't ring. Withdrawal symptoms.
Might be someone calling to say that we've gone off air.
Take my phone out of my cold, dead hand. Sorry, back to the topic, guys.
Not to say there's nothing in the future. There's certainly a lot of vendors hinting and previewing
They'd
stuff.
They have to be, wouldn't they?
They want to show us.
This is where the world's going. Everything's going as a service.
Mm.
This kind of facility makes sense. But I guess, as always, because we're dealing with file sizes which can get fairly hefty, having a fast internet is going to be a prerequisite to that, yeah?
But they're going to get bigger and bigger. I'd say a standard raw file for me is like 25 megabytes now. 5 years away, it'll be 100 at least. And then the internet will be faster then, but will it be fast enough?
No. Well,
it depends what you want to do on the cloud as well. Do you just want to store everything up into this cloud and then let everyone that you nominate pull stuff down?
Well,
from
I guess, the cloud promises many things. One is, I guess, backup, but then you've also got content distribution. Mm. You can push it in lots of different formats and out through the likes of Akamai or people like that, and you start to get distribution networks going. But then if you can't catalog and protect your work when it's in the cloud, then there's something missing, and a part of the puzzle's missing. So I guess that's what I'm interested to see what's coming. But if the answer right now is nothing, then let's leave it at that for today. But
there are a couple of programs that I've mentioned, something like Resource Space or Portfolio, that can be hosted on a server. So I'm going to sort of draw a long bow here. If we call it your own server, sort of a cloud solution, people can log in through any web browser.
Private cloud.
Cloud, you could do it that way. And you can do that to have many people keyword, because you might not know everything that was in that image, for example.
Now, Eden, you were talking in the break then about something that you do with generating JPEGs or smart JPEGs or...
Yeah, Lightroom has brought out functionality now. So before, you'd have your hard drive on the side of the computer and your USB port.
Yep.
What would happen is the catalog would be connected to the hard drive to view the images. What Lightroom's now done is it's brought out a thing called Smart Previews. And what that can do is, if you don't have the hard drive connected, say I get out of Sydney for the weekend and I take my laptop away, I can still edit the catalog images. And then as soon as I come back to Sydney and connect that hard drive...
It resyncs then.
It'll sync then. And it's a great functionality. It's also really good as well if I'm sending images offshore. Say I had a terabyte of data to send of the images. It's basically 14% of the data in Smart Previews. So it's a lot less data to send. Mm-hmm. And then I can send the catalogue over to be edited, and then that can be sent back. And it's easy. So I'm not sending that much data. So it's saving me time.
Right. So it would make sense that something like that will, within the not too distant future, would be able to sync across the net as well.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At the moment, it still syncs physically when the drive's reattached, yeah?
Mm. Well, catalogs aren't that big, predominantly. As such, the images they create...
They're just the database file.
Because you've got your raw files, and then once you import in, then it creates JPEGs. So the JPEGs are probably the biggest component of the catalogs. But really, I think if it'd be great having Lightroom as a multi-user platform where the catalog is instantly updated. Yeah. So you could, I could be in my studio and I could work from the first image and I could have my assistant working from the last image,
mm-hmm.
and we could edit a whole shoot and meet in the middle. Cool. That's what I'd love to do. Yeah. I'll be able to do.
Probably not that far off. Somebody's got to be working on that. You know.
Yeah. Also with cloud computing, my dream is to be able to go to Robert's studio one day or even go to your house or friends' places
and just log,
and just log into their computer, log into your computer, and instead of me bringing my laptop over and all my stuff, have everything in the cloud.
Yeah, that's, I guess, what I'm expecting it to be. I mean, it's funny. We talk about cloud computing as like this sort of, you know, rainbows and unicorns. It all happens in the cloud, and you know, no one really knows what's going on. At the bottom of it, there's computers and cables and operating systems. There's nothing much has changed there. It's just that we're finding new ways to use them. So
it'd be like having a like on my Windows computer, having a login where
we don't talk of Windows.
I know.
In the studio.
Windows 8, hey. And when I put in my password, boom, up comes my stuff. So say I use your computer, I logged in, boom, it's got everything that I've got.
That would be nice. Okay, well, I think we've pretty much covered digital asset management. I think we've managed it to death, I think, by now. But I've got a question which we'll deal with after the next music track, and it's specifically around stuff that you guys would know about. So can you hang around? And it's one of the questions I got during the week.
Sure.
And I think you guys will have some interesting input into it. So we've got to the last part of the show already, and it's a part where I do questions and answers. And one of the questions I got this week was around the issue of color calibration of a monitor. And the specific question was, how come the colors on the monitor look different when I print them? And the short answer there is that they're two different, completely different types of technologies generating that color. And you know, a screen or a monitor is a transmissive technology. It generates light from LEDs, and depending on how many bits are used in the LEDs, you get a different color saturation and whatnot. Whereas when you print something, not only have you got the vagaries of ink and, you know, the ink mixes and things like that, it's actually a reflective technology. It generates color by reflecting light differently. Robert, you're a bit of a color specialist, I think, but is this a thing that crops up all the time? This is the first time I've ever been asked it. Somebody said, well, why is it different? I said, well, two different ways of generating that for a start, but and either one of those variables could be out. So the trick would be to start with a monitor that is calibrated correctly. Is that right?
It is. So we were talking about that during Brian Ferry.
Yeah.
And like as Eden was saying, it's as any professional or even someone who cares about their images, you have to make sure your screen is at least calibrated. You can also calibrate your printer. In the old days before colour management, we used to do it by numbers. So you'd look at the numbers on the info palette and know that this grey or this blue had to be this certain amount of numbers.
So there was an RGB.
That's right, or CMYK for print. The beauty, and it really was a weight lifted off my shoulders when colour management was created, because it meant I could actually judge it like a human would, look at the colour on the screen knowing that it was accurate.
Sorry, we just used a couple of acronyms. Oh. RGB is red, green, blue, and there's a value between 0 and 255 associated with each one of those, and the mix of those three numbers generates the colour.
That's right.
Is that in a nutshell?
Yes. Correct. So 000 means you're looking at a black screen, you need to turn it on, and 255, 255, 255 minutes too bright, it's a bit white. So
right, and anything in between, and generally they have a kind of a slider control of some sort, and that...
And then you've got every colour that we can see and the colours we can't see as well, but... Calibrate, it really lifts the burden from you. You know that your screen... strongly, strongly recommend that you use a calibration device. Don't rely on your eye. Apple devices by nature, whether it's an iPhone or a Mac, come out of the factories very, very close to for proper calibration.
But like anything that's manufacturing tolerance, surely there'd be room for improvement?
Yes. So, you can actually... if we're allowed to mention a couple of products, you did mention one that looks like an insect side of...
As I keep saying, you know, we have to mention products in this product because in this broadcast, because the very nature of the thing is we're talking about this sort of stuff, and you can't describe something and not name it. So the one that I am familiar with is a thing called a Spider, and I think it was a Spider 4. Is that what you're using, Eden?
I use the Spider 3.
Right. So you've been superseded.
Yeah, but what's, I know my calibration's great with my lab that I print through. Everything comes back how I see it on screen when I'm editing images. I'm not editing in a bright studio. It's dark in there. Everything looks good. But when you calibrate laptops, big screens or whatever, what you'll notice is everyone's brightness is turned up to 100. And it's amazing because you're losing all the shadows, you're losing lots of details of the images. So
for somebody who has no idea what we're talking about, these things basically attach to the front of the screen and they see what you see, but they see it through a very objective lens that says this is the color mix that's coming out of the screen. And you can adjust it based on...
It's even better. It adjusts it for you. So what you do, you plug it in the USB. It's wizard-driven.
Spectrometer or something, I think.
It's a photospectrometer. But for a user, it means you plug it in, you watch the pretty colours flash in front of you, and at the end it says save, calibrate it. And you can see before and after how bad your monitor was.
Are these things expensive?
Like anything, it's all relative. Under $100 will get you an okay one. Right. But I don't know if it's any better than what comes native.
But is it the sort of thing you'd use once and then put in the cupboard?
You recalibrate just to make sure no one's come in and sabotage your monitor or your settings. So recommendation, and it can nag you if you want, I turn it off every month. It depends how much you use your computer. Right. But with the new technology, you mentioned LEDs, a lot more stable than the CRT.
Yeah, I mean, it's something I used to see a lot more. And the reason I say I haven't been asked recently is because just about everyone's using LCD monitors these days. No one I can't remember the last time I saw a CRT in the workplace.
Probably in those 70s film clips when I saw the songs. Yeah.
They're gone. They're on the side of the streets at clean-up days.
Yeah, unfortunately, they go into landfill and there's a lot of lead in those screens, but that's another story.
But yes, get a calibration device, a good one, if you want to know. Under $200 will buy you a very good one. It's against the software agreement. What you can do is hire a calibration person to come and calibrate your screen.
Right.
And they've got the license agreement to do that. Right. So I think the labs.
So once your monitor's calibrated, then if your printer doesn't get that right, then it's a problem with the printer. And I mean, the printer's $150 for an inkjet printer. What do you expect? It's going to do its best job of trying to mix inks.
You can actually calibrate your printer as well. Then it's a different. You can actually buy an all-in-one calibration device.
Right.
Then you're looking at probably double. So it's $300 to $400. It prints out pretty colours, and then you scan it with your calibration device, and it will build a profile for that paper and that ink.
Yes.
Or a lot of the labs we use now are basically just output devices. They'll have colour profiles. They'll give you. So it doesn't cost you any money if you use a good lab.
Okay.
And even if it's a mini lab, the better mini labs even have colour profiles.
Mm-hmm. So, Eden, you're using a Spider.
Love it, yeah.
Do you use the same device?
I use an X-Rite. I've used all of them, but I just like the device, that's all. It's like Eden shoots Canon, I shoot Nikon.
Right. I'm an Apple guy, he's a PC guy.
Yeah, it's the way it is. You use what works for you.
But there is an answer, and it fixes the problem. That way... you should do it if you're creating any visual content. So if you're writing a book, it's probably not important. If you're creating a design or a web design, you need to make sure what you're putting up there is to a standard.
Right.
The problem is...
So colour's important too. Even if you are taking...
Even black and white.
Yeah, if you're taking an image and sending it to the web for, and what gets rendered on a website is usually a fairly low-res, lightweight version of the original file, but you still want the colours to be right,
Well, my goal is to go out and calibrate the planet of every computer because, of course, we calibrate all our screens, but when you go out there, you don't know...
That's your goal?
No. No, well, the problem is, of course, everyone's got a different screen, so
I've
we
found
can...
somebody who's geekier than I am.
I've had it before with a client that rang me once and said, I'm looking at the images, the skin tones are not correct and all this. And I said, no, come into my studio, I can bring a laptop to you and show you. So... Because we're editing images, you don't want to edit images on a screen that's not calibrated because they're not going to be edited correctly.
Yeah, you're controlling one end of the variable, and then when it gets to his screen, if it's not rendering properly, then...
That's what I was hinting at.
Yeah, it's not your problem.
You can't control the output from the worldwide. So people might be looking at our websites now saying, gee, they're very dark photos.
Yeah.
It must have been something wrong that day. But a bit moody.
All right. So there are tools around.
There are tools.
And they're not wildly expensive, but you could get somebody to come and do it once.
Yes. So your local friendly camera store will have them, and the people there can talk to you about it.
Okay.
I say spend the money, buy a calibrating unit, and because you upgrade screens, you'll get new laptops, you'll use it for its lifetime.
And Spyder can actually calibrate an iPhone as well.
Wow, I didn't know that.